Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 3rd, 2006. Today's session is entitled Current Muslim Christian Issues, presented by Nellie Van Doren Harder. The number is VA-N 2006-6, and let's listen in.
Things were there that you heard in the news or that you just were discussing with colleagues about Islam, about Muslims, about the Muslim world, that really made you think, rattled your case, got your attention, and so forth and so forth. What things do you think I want to talk about today? Anything you can remember, anything you can think of?
I think a lot of people, the Christians, are afraid of the Muslims.
Fear is increasing. What are we afraid of? Why are we afraid?
The terrorism.
Terrorism, yeah. I mean...
And don't understand the Islams.
Yeah.
Don't know... I think there's a lot of polarity between... I think some people view Muslims as all being terrorists, and there's not an understanding of it.
Now, if we think about world affairs, what has terrorism brought us? Every day in the newspaper so far?
Bombings.
Where, mostly now, right now? Iraq. So we have this constant issue in Iraq. And then think a bit further. If we think about Iraq, who are the targets? First target?
Iraqi civilians.
They are much more a target, really, than Americans or Europeans. But who of the civilians attack each other?
Shiites
and Sunnites, right. So that's a big one, Shiites, Sunnites.
And then what is the difference between them?
Right. So that's why I'm going through these things. Then these topics come up and we can talk about them. What else? Yeah? You were first. I saw you earlier.
I really ticked that our nation's response to the Hamas elections.
Hamas elections, that's such a good one. And I can even say there's other elections. Anybody knows? Everybody, when we say Hamas elections, do we know what I'm talking about? Who says, I'm fuzzy right now, I didn't sleep
fuzzy
enough,
right
first night in Holden, okay? Hamas is the extremist-minded group that basically started attacking Israelis with suicide bombings and has now won the elections in Palestine. Because from, let's say, a terrorist organization, a guerrilla organization, it moved also into being a political party. Now, this happened in other countries too. Do we know which other countries have Hamas type?
Northern Ireland,
right? But the very good one, by
Israel.
The way. Keep this in mind. Israel, well, Northern Ireland is a good one, but I'm not thinking about Muslim world. Islamic governments right now, that where the Hamas-type groups won the elections or won a great part of the elections. Have we kept up with that? Iran? Lebanon, Hezbollah, right? So we have Hezbollah, which is in Lebanon. And Hezbollah was actually the one that invented the suicide bombing in the Middle East based on Islam. So who was it that told me? Was it you, Rick?
The Tamils
were the ones who actually invented it, but then it had to be translated to Islam. And Hezbollah was the first group to attack Israelis, you know, with the justification of the Islamic scriptures behind them. So that was Lebanon. And what we maybe haven't heard very much about, Egypt. The Muslim Brothers won a big part of the elections in Egypt. So we see suddenly, whoa, the whole of the Middle East, you know, there is a lot march of the, I don't want to say extremist, but extremist-minded groups going on. They're not all extremists, yeah? What else was in the news?
When I read about that group that wanted to blow up the Sears Tower in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
The question that came to my mind was, because they were all Americans, as I understood, they grew up in America with the school system here. What is it about their conviction of faith that overcomes their nationalism?
nationalism versus faith, right?
Right.
Yeah. As you see, there is no strong line in today's talk. Because I also want you, you know, if you have a burning question, I want to give you a chance to ask it. Yeah?
Well, one thing I've encountered, maybe not necessarily in the last year, but maybe 2 years, is the fact that some people are really adamant about the fact that actually, even though there's various degrees of Islam, that there's only one central tenet, and that is to have a revolution where everybody becomes Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And there are others that say, no, there are people of Islamic faith that are willing to work with Christians, coexist with them, and so forth. And I'm really kind of confused about what the real issue is. I mean, as far as, okay,
right.
Who's right? Are we both right? You know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And some people that had been stationed in, actually were in the involved in the Iraq war over in Iraq, were very vehement about the fact that even though the non-extremist Muslims, you know, practice coexistence, that's not really their real agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, for me, that's something I'd really like to have clarified, or at least put into perspective or whatever.
Okay, so we say agenda, and we also really talking about mindset, right?
Yes.
Mindset that comes from its theology or from the religious teachings.
That's what we're talking about.
Yeah. I always have concerns about treatment of women.
Women.
Ooh, just because. Were you there Friday when I talked about the women?
No, I had to work.
Oh, sorry about that.
I needed for you. Yeah?
Well, the regime in Iran, and this relates to the treatment of women, I read the book the Iranian student here in the U.S. actually recommended reading this book. She never intends to go back with her husband. She recommended Bin Laden's sister-in-law wrote a book.
Right.
Inside the Kingdom, I don't remember
right.
her first name, but
right.
it depicts the whole culture as very hypocritical.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bin Laden family is,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
controlling, but the whole structure is so unreal, unhappy.
Okay.
More than unhappy, it's so
hypocrisy.
Hypocrisy.
We know what I mean, right?
Mm-hmm. But
okay.
They're controlling
hypocritical, okay. What else? Anything else that caught you in the news that you say I want to have on the board, yeah?
Development of nuclear weapons by Iran.
Iran, nuclear weapons by Iran. And let's write Iran. It's not only nuclear weapons. Let's say Iran basically went nuclear on many levels. Because of who?
Can't pronounce his name.
Ahmadinejad, right? This new president, and you raised your hand, right?
The Danish cartoon flag.
We've mentioned that many times over the last. Those of you, the cartoons, they stood for everything. And when we talk about Europe, that will come out too. Yeah.
Thinking of the question of immigration, Muslim immigration, the perception of non-assimilation, I guess.
Assimilation. Well, that is a little bit of here, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Assimilation. Okay. Now, let me see what I had. I had two things that are not on there. The apostasy issue. That really hit me very hard. The apostasy in Afghanistan. Remember the one man who had become a Christian?
Oh, yeah.
And then, did you notice how it just went under the carpet? He just vanished. He seems to be in Italy. Nobody discussed it. Nobody said, well, isn't it a basic human right that this man became a Christian? Plus, aren't the Christians in the Quran? What is this? It just, you know, nobody wanted to upset the Muslim world about this. And you know, everybody kept silent about it. So the apostasy issue, which is, you know, very much connected with everything else. And then the other thing I have is the riots that you might have missed. There were a lot of Muslim Christian riots in different countries.
Mm-hmm.
Some came from the cartoon issue, but in Egypt, for example, do you remember?
I'm sorry, no, I was going to ask you to explain the word apostasy.
I'm sorry. Apostasy is when you leave Islam for another religion. So when you become a Christian or whatever.
Is that term used just only with Islam, or is that used in other faiths?
Well, it's mostly used with Islam because Islam is, as far as I know, the only religion where you are punished by death according to the official law if you leave Islam. So that is why this is a big issue.
Thank you.
Yeah, and then the riots, you know, in Alexandria, I don't know if you heard about that, in October there were huge riots that started with a deacon and a deaconess being stabbed, and then Muslims and Christians started to fight with each other, lots of cars and shops and businesses from Christians were burned down. Any of you heard about those? See, they didn't really, the riots in Egypt last year, and also this year, earlier this year, there were riots. And I think those come as little blips in the news, right? As little somethings, and you really have to be attuned. Your eye has to be, you know, really set for it to find them. Okay, now let us see what is happening in the world. First of all, in the world with Islam and our world. When I look at this, there is one word that you should always keep in mind. It's the big C word. Colonialism. Colonialism. That is a huge factor underlying everything that's happening now, that we see happen now. A lot of the countries in the Islamic world were colonized at one point, right? Think about Indonesia, largest Muslim country in the world, was colonized by one of the smallest countries in the world, being the Netherlands. You know, it is the balance was so uneven. Egypt had the British, India, where there's a large Muslim community, the British, you know, and then Lebanon, the French, and so forth, and so can go on and on. And that is one of that's of course the big issue with Palestine. We haven't written that on there, but we wrote Hamas, oh yeah, we have Palestine in a different context. So what we are seeing right now is several things. And let me just lay these out for you so that you can see how things are going. The Muslim world has been extremely frustrated, has felt extremely frustrated since the colonial powers were there and left. First, while the colonial powers were still present, for example, in Egypt, as an anti-reaction, the Muslim Brothers were set up. The Muslim Brothers were set up to strengthen Islamic identity, and to provide hospitals, clinics, education for Muslims to make sure that those services would not come from Christians. You see? That was the idea. If those people, you know, when you are dying or very sick, you're very maybe prone to conversion, dangerous, dangerous. We gotta take care of people ourselves. And that was the idea of the Muslim Brotherhood, which was set up in the 1920s in Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood started then as a social movement, right? Keep that in mind. So can we all follow me? Muslim Brotherhood, Egypt, against the Brits. Well, who of us is from British descendants? I mean, being from Holland, we feel the Brits are sometimes a bit obnoxious. But, you know.
So, being
so, you know, that the thing is that you know, you can imagine what these Muslims were thinking and feeling. So that's one thing, colonialism, the big C, colonialism. Then the other big C is Christianity. There is this huge fear, which is almost primordial within Islam, that the Christians want to take over. Well, and they did, of course, with colonialism, right? But colonialism was not to spread Christianity. No, it was to, you know, spread power, to exercise power. Later, the missionaries came. But what's very interesting, for example, in Indonesia, we were in Indonesia by the year 1600. Missionaries were not allowed into it until the beginning of the 20th century. The Dutch government did not want to mix business with religion, you know, let those souls save by themselves. But then the attitude changed. So you see, colonialism was not really to spread the faith. Now, but that the idea that Christians want to take over, and of course right now we do everything to support that idea, don't we? Right? That is something in the Muslim mind. I have so often heard, for example, I will give a talk somewhere in the Muslim world about a totally unrelated topic. And the first question is, so for example, they once asked me to talk about how the feminist movement in Holland came into existence and if it will break down society. So I'm done. The first question is, we heard that there is a big conspiracy of Christians moving into our country, converting to, and those two should convert to each, and you know, that scheme. That was the first question. And I said, why do you think you can be converted so easily? You see? And I said, no, but that's what we heard. And they say that in 10 years we will all be Christians. So why would you be Christians in 10 years? You haven't been Christian in 1400 years. So, you know? So you see, it is, I have said a lot this past week, a lot is in the mind, imagination, you know, fear. So there is also huge fear on the Muslim side. Now, so you have colonialization, you have the Christian issue. And by the 1970s, so the colonial periods were over, the colonizers had all gone home. By the 1970s, we have a third issue. And if we want to stick to the sea, we could call it the coin. Yeah?
Before you move to the third issue, on the second issue,
yeah?
Don't Christians also have that belief?
Absolutely.
If I'm not Christian, I'm going to die and go to hell.
Right, right. Well,
so
that's a very good one.
So much different.
Right. The thing is this, that for a Muslim, the greatest sin is to leave Islam. That's the greatest sin. And it is not in the Quran that you should be killed for it. But that was a law that was made after the first years, after the Prophet Muhammad died. He died in 632. When, just a few years later, the Bedouin tribes that had converted to Islam wanted to leave. And then the Muslim core said, but no, that's not in the picture. That's out of the question. So they fought them and forced them back into the Islamic fold, and then later on it became a law that you cannot leave Islam. And so, indeed, for a Muslim, the worst that can happen is to leave Islam, not just that you go to, because you don't really care if someone else goes to hell, right? If someone next to you goes, right? No, the thing is, you will be expelled because you are responsible for maintaining the community. Community, the other C, community, that's the fourth C. And so think about it. Community, think, that will come back in Europe, that will come back in America. How do you maintain that community here? It's a huge question. So, but now we go back to the third C, okay? Should I write them down or can we follow me?
It's
yeah?
Fine.
What?
It's fine.
You want me to write it down or it's okay?
No,
okay.
It's okay.
The coin, as in money, as in petrodollars, right? Saudi Arabia became more and more wealthy. Saudi Arabia looked at the Muslim world, especially the Middle East, and what was happening there? Well, a lot of stuff was going on. There was the ongoing battle with Israel, right? And the ongoing battle for Palestine. But also, a lot of the countries were kind of struggling with their government. The governments were not Islamic. The governments were mainly secular. Right? I mean, Mubarak in Egypt is not an Islamic president. He's a secular president. And so there was this big worry, oh my gosh, we're gonna lose it. You know? But now, the big enemy is not a C, but an S. Secularism. Secularism. That is the big next enemy. So the idea in Saudi Arabia was, we should train missionaries and send those out. And they started that, if I'm not mistaken, in the year 1974. In 1974, there was a huge conference in Saudi Arabia where they decided to set up special universities and special colleges to train Muslim missionaries and to send those first to the Middle East to make sure that the people in the Middle East knew exactly what Islam was about. So it was about purifying Islam. Purifying Islam. So get rid of the local cultural practices, get rid of all these visits to grave of Muslim saints. You know, people like to visit graves of the saints. Get rid of all the festivities. You know, there were these fun festivities that really were not connected to Islam, but there was a little bit of an Islamic gloss over them. People would read the Quran, would have a parade, like we have on the, like we'll have tomorrow, right? Just have fun together. That in Saudi Arabia is not done. So that all had to go. So these missionaries were sent out to purify Islam. And that group is growing. They will take poor kids from all over the world and ship them to Saudi Arabia, and there they will teach them the right faith, okay? Now, as we now fast forward to the now, we see lots of things happening in the world. We see, first of all, what we saw in the 70s was Russia and Afghanistan, the battle between Russia and Afghanistan. Well, that was, of course, absolutely a center of activity for those missionaries, and hence we have now Bin Laden. But then we had the breakdown of the former Soviet Union, right? All these, I always call them Stan countries, Tajikistan and so forth, became independent. Islam had been very much suppressed like any other expression of religion. So now suddenly you have lots and lots of Muslims in those countries who call themselves Muslim, are born Muslim, have no clue what it is to be a Muslim. Off go the missionaries. So you see the first exchange between those newly liberated people who want to go back to Islam is the pure or very, I call it Calvinist Islam, very puritanical form of Islam from Saudi Arabia. And you can go on. Former Yugoslavia, right? We had a lot of problems. Sudan, Darfur. Darfur is very much a battle against puritanical Muslims and non-puritanical Muslims. You know, the puritanical Muslims attacking the non-puritanical Muslims. So we see this evolve. We see it. This whole movement, as we now look at it, has become militaristic, has become very extremist. In some cases, it has become very violent. But the idea was to Islamize. And for example, a country like Indonesia, when Suharto, do we all know Suharto? When he was still the president, which was till 1998, he suppressed all these things because he was a smart man. He knew what could come. He didn't allow Shiites in the country because he was afraid then we get an Iranian revolution. And he suppressed all these extremists. They were all, you know, unless you stay quiet, I'll lock you up. That was how he went. The moment he was gone and the country became democratic, droves, ships, planes full of these missionaries came in, and they are now stirring up the population. You've heard a lot about Indonesia lately, haven't you? Much more than you ever asked for. Right. So that is why, because there are now these extremists, and they come out of nowhere. I remember, I lived in Indonesia during the time Suharto fell. So first we had all these riots in the street, you know? And then, when he had fallen, and when there was the successor, which was Habibie, his vice president, I mean, I think it took like 36 hours for these people to appear. And everybody thought, where were those hiding? You know, people in long robes like he wears in Saudi Arabia and a towel on their head. You know, where do these come from? We've never seen anything like it in Indonesia. They just came out of nowhere. They had been there, obviously, and were kind of hiding. So that is what we are also facing now. We are facing this huge drive that comes from Saudi Arabia to equalize Islam. And those missionaries, they go to places where there are big Muslim and Christian communities like Nigeria. That's where they are active. They're active here, very active, and I'll talk about that later in the week. They're active in Europe because what they want is one big unified Islamic universe, right? And then the final thought is, who of us woke up this morning and thought, what about the caliphate? Nobody? Do you remember when it fell? Do you remember when we had a caliph who was supposedly in charge of the whole Islamic world? Between 1923 and 1926, it's clear when exactly, because he kind of petered out, right? The caliph, who used to be situated in Turkey and in charge of what's called the Ottoman Empire, was disposed of, and we got then Ataturk, right? Now, the final dream is to get a new caliphate. One pesky little thing. What's the pesky little obstacle?
They can't agree among themselves? Is that
can't agree among themselves. Plus, Muslims are now all over the world. What are you going to do? All these, you know, stubborn Christians in the way. Right? So there is. So now, what we do now, what we see now, Iraq. There was a chance to start the caliphate. Because when you read all the writings of this Safawi, who was just killed, you know, that was his dream. He became the first new caliph by the way, it didn't fall in 1926. That's when they had the first conference to see how to get it back. 1926, it fell earlier. But 1926, so just to show you how much this is on the mind of people, they had a huge international conference, how do we get the caliphate back, right? So Iraq opened the window, this is going to be possible, you see? So that is also a dream, just unify everybody and then build a new empire again. And now you want a new empire because you have the US, right? And you have China, so and you have Europe, so you want a Muslim empire vis-a-vis that. Does that make sense?
Is that a political empire?
It's extremely political. It's extremely, extremely political in the name of Islam. Because as you know, Islam and politics go hand in hand. According to the official Islamic ruling, a Muslim should live in a Muslim society and be ruled by a Muslim. That is again a big problem of Muslims in the West. You know, there are all these discussions. Can we live here? Should we live here? The government is not Islamic.
So is the goal one large Islamic state?
That is the goal. Very much the same as the Ottoman Empire was, which was the last large Islamic state. Yeah, and that fell around the First World War. And then 10 years later, they had this huge mega meeting. How can we get it back? Yeah.
And what I'm trying to get clear about, as you described it, it's the goal of these purist Islamists.
Right.
There is a large intellectual secular Islamist community that doesn't buy that model.
That, right. I was going to come to that, okay. The hypocrites.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Thanks. Because, you know, the thing is this, again, remember, it's all in the mind. It's all imagined. A lot is imagined. A lot is a dream. Right? Because if Muslims really would live under a caliph, I don't know how long that caliph would last. You know? Because this is no longer the simple society from the early days of Islam, when everything, you know, could be reached by horse. No, things have become much more complex. But thanks, Rick. Let's move to the next version, the next part or the next phase, I mean. Because what you see, so you look at Hamas, you look at Hezbollah, you look at the Muslim Brothers. What they really wanted is empowerment of Muslims. What they really wanted is eradicate the Christian heritage, you see? Make the Christian hospitals Islamic again. Teach the Muslims again. However, several of them, or all three of them, took up arms. That was the problem. They took up arms. And they became, inside their own societies, a sort of anti-power. Now, what are they battling, right? From the outside, they're battling Christians. But from the inside, they're not. They're battling each other. They're battling other Muslims. Because, remember the S word, secular? That is way more dangerous nowadays than the Christians. The secularism, and what, as Rick says, if you go to a Muslim country, you see everything together. You are in Egypt, you see tank tops next to women in a full burqa.
That's right.
You see it both, right? There's a mix of all kinds of people going through each other and everybody making a statement. The tank top makes a statement that don't touch me. I'm a Muslim, but that's my business. Right? So you go to a Muslim country, and a lot of people are Muslims the way we are Christians. The vision, they don't want the state to rule over their religion. They want a division between religion and state, between church and state. They want to decide for themselves. A lot of people are very secular. They know the Quran, they know Islam, but they're extremely secular. A lot of people do not agree with these groups, but unfortunately, these groups are the only ones that are really very well organized, because who gives them a little financial assistance once in a while?
The Saudis.
The Saudis, right. So you see, it is the Saudis, they give lots of money to groups that have organized themselves in certain countries and that have a mindset very much like what the Saudis, you know, appreciate, so to speak. Yeah?
And don't they really blame the Western Christians for the secularization? We're the scapegoat, so
yeah.
to speak.
Yeah, the West is the source of secularism, and they know very well how that came about, you know, the Enlightenment, and they know very well the division of church and state. They don't go further, however. They don't go as far as understanding that we came up with that model because we were killing each other so much in the name of Christianity after the Reformation, that some wise leader said, if people go on like this, we have nobody left. We got to do something. We got to, you know, and that was the beginning of the first peace treaties. Like let people do what they want, because what is the alternative? It is war, religious wars, and we fought. I mean, in the Netherlands, we had 80 years of religious war with Spain, you know, and go figure. I mean, why did Spain want to come in this cold, wet, and so forth country? Never mind. And they had nothing to gain. But you see that, no, Indonesia was not there yet. That was after Spain left. Then we could go out and occupy ourselves. Anyway, but you see, this is what we are looking at. Now, so these Hamas, Hezbollah, Muslim Brothers, and more extreme groups, they want to purify Islam. They want to unify Islam, all the Muslims. They want to divide the world between us and them. And us is everybody who's puritanical, right? However that looks like. And them is everybody else. So among them are tons and tons of Muslims. That's what we keep forgetting. The first target of extremists are Muslims. That's the first target. Might you be a Christian living in the Middle East, such as in Egypt, you are the first target, and the second target are Muslims, because you're so handily available, right? So you're there. So that is, so this is how the Christians in Egypt figured out what was happening in the Muslim world long before we figured it out. By the 1970s, attacks on their churches and property started. So by the end of the 70s, 78, you see it start. You see, so by then, missionaries had obviously started to come in and started to spread their word. And the first idea was, they didn't even think about the West at that time, it was local. And the first idea was, these Christians should not be here. These Christians should have been converted long ago. Because Egypt was 100%, well, not 100%, it was Christian, Pharaonic, Roman, Greco, but the Christian church was very strong in Egypt when Islam came in. And over time, people converted. So you see, those are the people who noticed first what was happening in the Muslim world. Now, if we now stop in Iran for 1 minute, stop in Iran. We see now a president, and did you see his letter, the letter to Bush? Mm-hmm. You know, he wrote a letter to President Bush. Have you seen what it, who has read the letter? Mm-hmm. You have read the letter. Do you remember what it said?
Well, it sounded good. It sounded like we want peace and we want to work together with you. But
yeah.
That wasn't the way it was interpreted.
Right. You can interpret it that way.
Yeah.
But he also is saying that Bush is not a good Christian. Have you noticed that? He is saying what you are doing, and what he's actually saying is Muslims, Christians, Jews, all, you know, go back to the monotheistic religions. And what Bush is doing is very much against all three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
It's against all three religions. That's what he's saying. And in a way, he...
Who is saying this?
The the president of Iran. The president of Iran. So in a way, what he has done, and this is very much connected with the nuclear power that we are struggling with. The president of Iran is now standing up and say, I'll show them. All the Christians, all the seculars, all the feminists, I'll show them. We Muslims can win. We are better. We are now at a point where we are strong enough to deal with our own business. So that is why we want nuclear energy. But also, there are lots of other things happening in Iran. Just a few weeks ago, there was a big demonstration of women. Have you heard about that demonstration? Who heard about it? It was a big demonstration, mostly feminist. Half of them are in jail now. Because the problem is, with Ahmadinejad's society, Iran, it has moved on since Khomeini, right? We had the Iranian Revolution in 78. Suddenly, all the laws became Islamic. Give it a few years and people realize these laws don't work. They don't work. I gave as an example the child marriage. Remember? Those of you who were there, marriage, there's no minimum age of marriage in Islam. So that's what Khomeini reintroduced. Well, by the time people went through their 9-year-old marrying a 56-year-old man, suddenly people started to reconsider. That's not a good law. The modern law of a minimum age of 16 is actually much better. So they have reintroduced that. You see?
But Iran's a little special case because of the Shah, Reza Pahlavi, who had secularized the society. So the Muslims there had a chance to see how the other half lived.
Right. Well,
so in a society that had been Muslim for centuries, I don't know that they had that same recollection and understanding, because if I grew up believing that 9-year-olds married, maybe I married one, I think I'd continue to do that because that's sort of all I knew.
Mm-hmm.
But in Iran, you know, when the Shah was there, they were like, oh, there's a different way.
Right. Well,
plus there was so much corruption.
It was too secular. It was too secular under the Shah. Yeah, and a lot of corruption. Well, that's the other C word. We didn't get there yet. Corruption is huge in all those Muslim countries. And that's another way, you know, that's why Hamas won. Because people thought we'll get rid of the corruption. That's why the Muslim Brothers won. And I'll come back to that in a minute. I have to keep an eye on the time.
The other C in relation to him is CNN. Because you travel in those parts of the world, and every village has a little battery,
right?
And TV hooked up to it, and a little satellite, and they see the rest of the world.
Right.
The rest of the world is available to them.
Right.
And then the kids are playing games the rest of the time.
Right.
On the
same unit. And internet.
Yeah.
Internet. You know, it's huge. So okay, let's go from the extremist to the more interesting part of society. The extremists are, well, because I've met many, and I've met them in many countries, and they're so utterly boring. They all read the same books, quote the same texts, you know. It's just as if all of us would learn a book by Luther by heart and throw that at each other all day, you know. And we take the Gospel of Mark, and we take the book by Luther, and we read a psalm or two, and that's it. And they read the Quran very, very, you know, they know it. But what they highlight is very limited, and they don't know their tradition very well, extremists, because they don't want to know the tradition, because the tradition is much more open and tolerant than what they want it to be. You see? So they're actually really boring people.
Christians do that too.
Yeah, right.
I know. Has any of you ever had one of these interfaith sessions where you felt someone is trying to convert me with Muslims? Yeah, I mean, and you have 10 of them, and they're all the same. They will all go back to the same arguments, use the same text. It's so boring. And yeah, Christians do it too.
Yeah,
I think, and probably Hindus too, if they can get away with it, because the Hindu tradition is so huge. Anyway, so we have all these C's: Christianity, right? The money. That was a good one, CNN. That is, you know, because it's coming at us. Oh gosh, we're in danger. And corruption is huge. So Ahmadinejad has now portrayed himself as someone who's against all those seas. That's the thing. That's how he casts himself. I'm here speaking on behalf of the real Muslims. Why does he want to do that, most of all? What do you think? Why does he feel himself so cold? He feels himself, if you hear him talk, he feels himself like a prophet, you know? And he talked to the UN. Have you ever heard how he considered his speech to the UN? Who heard about that? In Iran, he told the people back home that everybody was just in awe, and he felt that they came in trance, and they were all listening to his Islamic explanation. And he felt that if he had had a few more minutes, all of them would have become Muslims. Yeah, that's what he said back home. And he had, talking at the United Nations in Geneva. So, what do you think is his main issue?
He wants to be the next caliph.
Yeah, he wants to be the next caliph. Can he be the next caliph, however?
No,
He's not a Sunni. He's not a Sunni. Right, he's a Shiite. That's a big problem if you want to be caliph. You have to be a Sunni. So you see, he wants to somehow, now we have this Muslim empowerment with everything happening. We have Bin Laden still hiding, not being caught yet. He wants to stand up and say, look, we can do it. However, at home he has a lot of problems. Have you heard of the problems he has at home? Because people no longer want to be all dressed in black, covering their ankles. Couples are sitting together on benches in the park, sometimes even holding hands. I mean, in the old days, the police would come, just after the revolution, they had this moral police that would come and arrest you or beat you up. And there's another huge problem that I was never aware of. He has to choose between wine and drugs. Did you know that?
Big drug problem.
I read that article the other day. Because if you think about the poetry from Iran, the poetry from like 1,000 years ago, it's all about wine. And wine stands for, ecstasy and getting close to God. And I never realized that Iranians drink wine up the wazoo. and now his problem is, if I forbid all the wine, they'll do the drugs. And wine is in the Quran, yes. Alcohol, drugs are not, right? Because Iran was the biggest opium-eating country before Khomeini came. So he has to choose. So he obviously has given way to the wine. And there's a huge, underground black market selling alcohol in Iran. I had no clue. I've never been in Iran. But just so you see, at home, things are brewing. And he wants to stand up and say, look how strong we are. Look how wonderful we are. And of course, the other thing with the Shiites is what happens in Iraq, where Shiites are being attacked all the time, where they blew up, we should have written that there, the shrine, the big shrine that was blown up.
Right.
Was it in February? February or March? It was just in late winter, early spring. They blew up the biggest Shiite shrine in the Shiite world. This was not just Iraq. Because did we know what that shrine was? What happened at that shrine? Yeah. Right, the Imam, the last Mahdi, the last Imam. Shiites believe that there are Imams and that were the descendants of the Prophet. And that's the difference between Sunnites and Shiites. Shiites say, and the quarrel goes back to the day the Prophet Muhammad died. There were two groups. One group said, we should now choose as a replacement someone who's capable and old enough and has the authority to lead the community. Shiites, what later on became Shiites, said, no, it has to be someone from the family. And the Prophet had a cousin called Ali. And Ali became only the fourth caliph. So the first three were chosen democratically because they found that Ali was too young. And the fourth was Ali. But by the time Ali came around, the empire had already spread, and in the different parts you already had very strong governors. And so when Ali wanted to take over and take power and exercise authority, they said, well, I don't care about Ali. Let him sit there in Medina. I don't care. And the, and these governors went their own way, you see? And so it came to a clash, and it's too complicated to explain it all. It came to a clash between one of the governors and Ali. And Ali was killed. And that was the end of the first four caliphs, the first four successors of the Prophet Muhammad. Who ruled over one empire, which was tiny at that time. Then the empire, you know, evolved, and you have a caliph in Egypt, and a caliph in Syria, and a caliph here, a caliph there. Can we follow me? Yeah? Now, what happened then was that people kept pushing Ali's sons, Hassan and Hussein, that one of them would claim the place of a caliph. Hassan couldn't do it because, according to the tradition and the rumors, he was killed by one of his many wives, poisoned. Hussein, however, tried. He tried to take back the authority from the strong governor, and it came to a clash, and Hussein was killed. According to the tradition, one of his sons escaped. According to the Shiite tradition, that son then led the Muslims, but more or less in secret. He was there, he was visible, but he led them. And according to Shiites, there are seven, depending which branch of the Shiites you follow, there are 7 or 12 descendants of Hussein. Can we all follow me? Yeah? 7 or 12. And the last one, the 12th one, kind of vanished, disappeared, went up to heaven, never really visibly died. And where did that happen? The shrine that was bombed by the Sunnites. The shrine, the name escapes me where it was, the city.
Najaf?
No, it wasn't in Najaf. It was closed there. It's a special name of the city. Well, anyway, but you know my point. Because all Shiites in the whole world believe that that Imam will come back one day, that he's now hidden. He's hidden, right? And guiding us, or Shiites, from afar, and then one day we'll come back, and guess where? At the place where the shrine was, that was bombed. There were even horses parked around that shrine for many centuries in case he came back and needed a horse. Yeah, so that is how real that belief is. So can you imagine bombing that shrine? What that means? So you see now suddenly the president of Iran standing up, you know, kind of somehow encouraging the Shiites in the world. You see, he's playing a huge symbolic role right now. But we only think it's nuclear power and, you know, it's the West against the East. No, it's not. He's also giving a message to all the Shiites wherever they are, because they're not only in Iran. Do we see the difference between the two? And I'll look up the name of the place of the shrine.
Was he actually presenting himself as the Messiah? I mean, is he presenting himself? Is he setting himself up to be the?
You mean Ahmadinejad?
Yeah.
No, he cannot do that. But he can present himself as a religious leader. Yeah, he can do that. But because in Shiism, the leaders of the community, the Ayatollahs, we've all heard of that word, right? The Ayatollahs, they actually are considered spiritual descendants of this last Imam, who is now somehow in occultation or, you know, in hiding. So you see, that gives them a very specific place. So the more he can dream about that Imam, the more visions he has of that Imam, the more powerful he will become. Yeah. So we see there's what we are looking at, and now let's go for a minute to the hypocrisy. Because, as I say, within the societies, there's huge corruption issues, huge issues between poor and rich, and all these discussions of, we are Muslims, we shouldn't have poor people. We are Muslims, things should be divided equally. We are Muslims, we should have a just society. Well, 2005, a book was published in Egypt, and I cannot remember the writer, but I do remember the title. It's called The Yacoubian Building. So if you go on Amazon.com, you will find it. The Yacoubian Building. And it is published by AUC Press, the American University of Cairo Press. that book has put the whole of Egypt on its head. Why? Because the writer, who's a dentist, he describes a building, a department building, and he describes the inhabitants of the different apartments. One is a businessman who follows all the rules of Islam that are visible, that are visible. He prays five times a day, preferably with the window open so that people can see him pray, right? He goes on the pilgrimage, he pays his charity, he fasts with Ramadan. So that is his exterior. The other one, who's more or less opposite him, is a Muslim who womanizes. He's a terrible womanizer, he always has girlfriends. And then there is a very poor family, and there's a gay couple, all in that building. And we follow them all, and while you follow them, you see, for example, how the poor family, the son wants to join the police, but he's too poor to pay the bribe, to be allowed to do the exam. Then he finally gets the bribe somewhere, and he's allowed to do the exam, and he comes out number one. However, some son of a general wants to join the police too. So the boy is kicked out, and the general's son, without even doing the exam, comes in. Where does the boy end up? What do you think? He becomes an extremist. Right. He falls into the hands of a sheikh who preaches a lot of violence, but the violence is, you are worth something. You know, and you're going to stand up against the corrupt police. And so in the end, he tries to bomb the chief of police. And with the suicide bomb, he tries to kill him, and he's killed himself, and the chief is not. But that, so you see, and then the man who is so religious, what does he do? He, for first of all, in the book we find out that his huge wealth is based on drug trafficking. That's where he gets his wealth from. But the government knows this, but they let him because he pays them generously. So they let him. Then we find out that he marries a second wife illegally, because you can marry four wives, but you have to do it legally. You have to do it according to Muslim law. He's not following the Muslim law. He does it illegally. Then we find out that his second wife is pregnant. His kids are already in their 40s. He doesn't want a baby. He forces her to have an abortion. Forbidden by Islam. So he finds an imam who says abortion is fine. You see, and in the end you see them force the woman. They kidnap her, they drug her, they give her an abortion. So in the end, everything turns around. Who's the hypocrite in the book? And the womanizer, he's full of love in the sense that he picks up these poor women, he cleans them up, helps them find a job. You know, in the end, you have much more sympathy for him than for any of the other characters. So the whole of Egypt is upside down with that book, because everybody recognizes something. And everybody knows it's true. And everybody knows that all this talk about Islam, you know, you can go on and on, but you don't really solve the crucial problems in society. And by now, it's made into a movie already. Imagine, it's made into a movie, it has made such waves. So you see, when you say hypocrisy, that is a huge issue. Now, finally, the first question. Do we still have time? Yeah. The first question, like, how can these people want to bomb the Sears Tower? Right? They come to the States. Now, so Muslims come here, they come to the States. Yes, there are issues of poverty, but these are not their issues. It's not their problem. Especially not, you go, most Muslims who come here are middle class and up. They are professionals, they earn well. Very few really poor Muslims here, as far as I know. Do you know something, maybe where you live is different? But I'm not aware of Muslims, you know. You?
Well, yeah, refugees.
Right, that's the next thing I was going to say. But Muslim, the immigrants. The people who voluntarily immigrated, I'm not aware of any of those being poor. The exception, thank you, refugees. Refugees is a very different category. But if you think about the Muslims, especially from the Middle East, Pakistan, India, and so forth, right, Iran, lots of people from Iran, they came here, most, even the refugees from Iran are quite wealthy, because it were the people who didn't want Khomeini to take their money, so they got out. Now, but... So we leave the refugees separately for a minute, right? because they're still struggling with their own issues. But the others, the thing is, they do not have these issues that I just described from the Yacoubian building. You see? They don't have the poverty, the grinding poverty, and they very much stay in their ethnic society, so they will not mix with a Bosnian refugee. You see? They stay with their own groups and they build their own groups. Then they somehow can, you know, live Islam in a small community, and they can make that community as pure as they like it to be. Because there's no corruption, right? As far as I know, there's much less corruption in the United States of America than there is in the Middle East. But I might be wrong. I might have a black spot here in my observation. But here you want to go, you apply for a job, you can. You want to go to school, you do you read, or what do you call it, you apply, and you get in or you don't get in. But it is based on merit, on your grades. It's not based on which family you come from. Isn't that so?
That's true.
Right. Well, not all. You need
Yeah.
Legacies,
right. But often the families have enough money to and support.
Like Bush, for example.
Right. No, but Muslim families, they often can manage to, you know, their kids can go to school and so forth. But anyway, the corruption is much less than back home. That's one thing. So you can make this pure society. However, this pure society has lots of questions. Lots of questions. What do we do in this sea of unbelievers? What do we do in this ocean of media that come at us? How can we protect ourselves? And when you try to answer that question, you can fall in the hands of some imam who tells you, well, you can protect yourself by never to mix with the rest of society. So you stay away, you don't mix. You have a job, you don't talk to them. You go home and you only stay with your own people. Now that's the first step. If you do peace studies, that's the first step of defacing someone, of dehumanizing. Don't talk with them, don't interact. Because when you interact, you get to know each other and you might get sympathetic. Don't interact, then you stay pure. And so they can move further and further away from real society. The next step could be they have their own business with only like-minded Muslims. The third step can be they have their own business and their own little mosque group. And you hear often the complaint in mosques, we have this group that is trying to break us up. You see, mosques are complaining about this too, when these extremist groups move in and stir up trouble in the mosque. And so you can remove yourself further and further away from society. And then you come into the mechanisms of a gang or a sect. Were you the one who asked the question? Who asked the question about how can these people want to blow up the Sears Tower? So then, and what I read in research, it's like going in a house. You go in the door, and every time you go up, the stairs, the door behind you closes. And in the end, you're in the attic, and you cannot go back any longer. You see, so there's a combination going on of group formation, brainwashing, but especially making the other an unknown entity and making the other into something you can kill. In some, it doesn't matter what the other is, it's not you, and the other is impure. So this is in a very simple way to say, this is what is behind that wish to blow up the Sears Tower. Because these small groups, you know, when they are caught, before they do things like that, they almost have to be, you know, de-brainwashed. You have to treat them in many ways like you would treat someone who is in a sect or in a gang. And that is, of course, difficult for us because you need Muslims to do that. So that is what we're seeing. But the whole thing comes, where does the anger come from? And then we have to stop. Where does the anger come from? Because it's based on anger. It's based on the first step you take because you're angry. You want to be pure, but you also want to, you're angry. You're angry about what? You're a Muslim, you sit in America, you're angry, you feel powerless. What are you angry about?
Our geopolitical position.
What?
Our geopolitical position.
The political position?
Of the US versus Israel.
Exactly. You're angry about what's happening in Iraq. What else are you angry about?
Israel.
What else are you angry about? And it's all in this letter from Ahmadinejad. He mentions it one by one. You're angry about Israel. You're angry about Afghanistan. You're angry about Iraq. You're angry about just plain old neo-colonialism. For example, he mentions the people of Africa. He mentions the people of Africa. And then he goes on about the brave and faithful people of Iran. So you see, when you look at this, you see that you're angry about the media. You're angry, he mentions the media. So there's so many things you're angry about, and what you do is you condense all that anger and you somehow translate it into, this is all the fault of America. This is all the fault of the US. And then from there you say, this is the fault of the West. And from there you can go on and say, it's the fault of the Christians. Do I make sense? Mm-hmm. So you can go on and on creating your enemy. And of course, I forgot one big one, the big J word, the Jews. They are the fault of everything. You see? And so that is how you can come to that mindset. It doesn't come overnight. Think about it. It took 30 years. Let's say a little less, 25 years, to get the really all-out suicide attacks that we have now. You see, Iraq would not have been possible without Hezbollah doing the first suicide attack in Lebanon. That was in the 70s too, and what you get then is a whole system where you train children, train young people, open their mind for the possibility of becoming a suicide killer. You see, this does not come overnight. I'm sure Jody and Ingrid can talk about that too. You know, when you have people who are totally off the track, that doesn't happen in a week. You don't go off the track in a week. This is a long process. Convicts in jail, often they had terrible childhoods, they had to go through all kinds of terrible experiences. Communities, how do they rise up? How do they fall? This is not a one-night process. It's the same with Muslim extremism. It's the same with the suicide bombings. It's a long process. So now, what can we do? Apart from go for lunch. But what can we do? We can do a lot. Keep talking. Keep making connections. I have several extremists that I visit regularly in Cairo. So how many people want to kill now? You know, and because they told me, the first time I met one of them, he said he wanted to kill the whole world. I said, you'll kill my kids. Does it matter? Oh, they're just victims of war. No problem. But the thing is, as he gets older, and as he talks more and more with people, he's mellowing. He's mellowing. Now he doesn't want to bomb the whole world any longer. Now he just wants a big, big Muslim empire. And we stay out of it. Well, that's fine. You can have that, as far as I'm concerned. Just pick your place. But, you know, if that's what you want, if you don't, but then you have to cut out CNN. Do you think the people of Egypt are going to get rid of the dish? No way. You go to Egypt. Who has been to Egypt lately? Did you see all the dishes as you land?
Well, actually, I lived over there for a little over a year, 86, but even at that time, there were huge dishes outside of Cairo.
But now you land, it's like a forest of mushrooms. There's a dish on every roof. There's no way you can get rid of those. As you say, Iran during the revolution, that book, Reading Lolita in Tehran, it tells about the dish hidden on the balcony, right? There's no way that you cannot turn the clock back, but that's what people want. So again, imagination in the mind, dreams, you know, and they can be very powerful. And so I do, and that is happening too. In many countries, they try to set up schools to retrain kids. Because there's another thing, you know. There are very few parents, maybe apart from in Palestine, that has a very specific position, who want to lose their child. Very few parents want to lose their child. So a lot of parents have woken up, like in Egypt, to the reality, my son can become, you know, an extremist, which means he'll end up in jail, he might be killed, I don't want that. So you now also see all over the Muslim world a very small movement of schools and reconciliation efforts. And do you know of any, Rick?
Yeah, but I was going to speak to something else.
Okay.
The big risk is that what's made this possible has been petro money. I mean, the Saudi, you talk about the Saudi missionaries, they have been able to do that because of the price of oil, because we in the West have basically, bought their oil.
We have
now, the problem is, if we stop buying their oil, they have not developed any kind of economic base that is anything other than resource driven.
You mean the Saudis?
The Saudis, nor the...
I don't know. They're moving into lots of other businesses.
I understand, but at least the stuff that I'm reading is saying that it's very fragile, and that they're not in a position to enter the world economy in any meaningful way for many, many years, because they have not focused on that kind of development. So let's say we were to withdraw. Let's say we were to conserve and go to hybrids and do ethanol and all that kind of stuff, and the price of oil went down to $20 a barrel, and they can't provide for the needs. That's my concern, is at that point, they no longer have the resources to do some of the things they're doing now, but they also then create a set of economic conditions that make people even more desperate.
But wait. What do they use the money for? They do not use it to help economies in Muslim countries. They do not. They use it to spread Islam.
But there's some kind of social safety net.
Not, for example, Indonesia had that huge crisis, the economic crisis in 98, right? Now, you know what an economic crisis is. You come out of your door one morning and your bread that you want to buy has gone up from $1 to $20. And you suddenly realize, I cannot afford bread. That's an economic crisis. You know what the Saudis did in Indonesia, largest Muslim country in the world? They kept supporting veils. You could buy veils and Muslim garb for next to nothing. They never gave a cent for food. Never. So I'm not that worried.
Okay.
They might implode, but I don't think they will, because I think they invested an awful lot all over the world. And look at the Gulf countries, like we had the big, we didn't talk about that, the harbor issue, right? That, a lot of the Gulf countries, they are already diversifying. They know the oil is going to run out one day. Mm-hmm. But I think it's so important to realize this, a lot of this would not have happened if there were not this money used for specifically that purpose, and it is so evil. They could have used it to battle that poverty and that corruption, and they could have used it for so many other things, you see. But for them, all these other social and economic issues don't matter. What matters is what? Purified domination of Islam. It's as simple as that. That's what matters according to them. And then, again, this dream, again, this imagination. Because we found that out in little incidents. Then they feel, God will just step in and just make everything right. If we are pure, if we are Islamic, if we dominate, the rest will come by, automatically. How do we know that? For example, remember when Sadat was killed, President Sadat in Egypt? The next day after he was murdered, they found a little kind of a testament in the street of one of the people who had shot him. And that was available for maybe an hour. And then the government saw it and confiscated it. And some people bought it. That starts with that. From that writing, it's called The Forgotten Duty. What is The Forgotten Duty? Jihad. The Forgotten Duty, that's what it's called. What do we learn from that? Two things. It starts out with the following words. We have the Sea of Alexandria, we have the Sea of Jerusalem, we have the Sea of Antioquia, and we have the Sea of Constantinople. As the Sea of a Pope. What is left the Sea of?
Rome.
Where were the five seas in the beginning of Christianity? Rome. We don't have that yet. That was the first statement. We have Alexandria, Antioquia, Constantinople and Jerusalem, which is the Middle East. That were in the early days of Christianity, those were the five centers of Christianity, mm-hmm. with Rome. They don't have Rome yet. Never mind, I mean, after all of South America, don't think about that. Second thing was that they honestly believed that by killing Sadat, they had no escape plan. By killing Sadat, somehow heaven would break open and angels would descend and help these good, pure Muslims. And, you know, praise them and award them for killing Sadat. The last thing they...